Well, we've finally made it, Constant Listeners. It is officially March, and I know winter is not over yet, and spring is not technically here yet, but just being able to flip the calendar from February to March provides an immediate morale boost to Northerners like myself, who've made it through yet another gray, cold, and dreary winter. And if you're in a similar geographic latitude that I am, congratulations to you as well for making it through the worst of winter. This episode 93 first airs on March 1st, which also happens to be the birthday of one of my favorite television actors of all time, which is Robert Conrad. As a kid, I was obsessed with watching two of his television series, The Wild Wild West and Baa Baa Black Sheep. Both were awesome. Robert Conrad was an excellent actor in his time. I think we briefly discussed The Wild Wild West on a prior episode of The Far Middle, but I really do need to dedicate some time to discuss the topic of that very creative and quite unconventional television series in more detail. Maybe I'll post something on the nickdeolias.com website soon. But happy birthday to Robert Conrad, who dares you to knock that ever-ready battery off of his shoulder. Some of you are old enough to remember that commercial for the battery maker. That was before battery companies went the route of branding through things like bunnies. Let's get to our dedication in the world of sports. We've been on a bit of a theme recently in prior episodes. I don't know if you've noticed that or not, where we're trying to tie the dedication to not just the athletic achievement of an individual, but also to an additional facet that mirrors the positive aspects of the human spirit. And we have yet another opportunity that reflects both athletic achievement as well as personal endurance with our episode 93 dedication, because our dedication is going to go to Mario Lemieux and what he accomplished specifically, particularly in the 1992 to 1993 NHL season with the Pittsburgh Penguins. So 93 tied to Lemieux's 92-93 season in the NHL. I know you might think that I'm a bit fixated on number 66, Mario Lemieux. We dedicated episode 66 to him, and we included him as well in a joint dedication a few episodes back. But that's what happens with Mount Rushmore-type greats. But I have to say that Lemieux's 1992-93 season, it has no parallel, I believe, in the world of sports, let alone hockey, because it combined unprecedented performance in both on-ice metrics as well as off-the-ice perseverance. I mean, you could make a movie about the single season that Lemieux posted in 92-93. And let me start with those on-ice statistics. Lemieux ended up notching 160 points in just 60 games. And you do the math, that works out to 2.6 points per game. That's over a goal a game and over 1.5 assists per game. That season, Lemieux started fast. He logged 12 consecutive games at the start of the season where he had multiple points in each. That's an amazing statistic. And by the time he got to the end of 1992 and in early January 1993, Lemieux was on pace to be the second player to surpass 200 points in a season and maybe even break Wayne Gretzky's all-time single-season points record of 215. But something happened off the ice in early January of 1993 to Lemieux. He noticed a lump on his neck, and he was quickly diagnosed with the early stages of Hodgkin lymphoma. And immediately, he underwent radiation treatments in his season, and perhaps his career was suspended. And with this being Mario Lemieux, his intention all along was to get the proper treatment to overcome the cancer and then to quickly return to the ice. And guess what? You know, he did just that. He returned to the ice on March 2nd of 1993, and under the category of you can't make this stuff up, he received his last radiation treatment in the morning of March 2nd, and then he played a game against the Philadelphia Flyers during the evening of March the 2nd. And oh yes, he notched a goal and an assist in that game against the Flyers. Then Lemieux proceeded to go on an absolute tear during the rest of the regular season in 1993. The Penguins rattled off 17 straight wins upon his return. There was a game that I'll never forget during that run against the Rangers in Madison Square Garden, where Lemieux scored 5 goals in a single game. And by the way, I was once lucky enough to attend a Penguins-Rangers game at Madison Square Garden with Mario Lemieux after he had retired and was the owner of the team. And when the game was over and we were leaving the building, I was shocked and pleasantly shocked to see how many Rangers fans came up to Lemieux and treated him with great respect. New York fans, I know they've got a reputation of being gruff, but they know greatness and class when they see it. Now, Philadelphia Flyers fans, that's perhaps a little bit of a different story, but I'll leave that for another episode of The Far Middle. Anyway, another amazing feat during that season was that during Lemieux's absence because of his illness, the Islanders phenom, Pat LaFontaine, he took the lead for the league scoring title. And when Lemieux returned in early March, he was significantly behind LaFontaine. But guess what? Throughout the latter part of the season, Lemieux actually heated up and amped up his scoring pace higher than what it was before he was diagnosed with Hodgkin's. And yes, he ended up catching and surpassing Pat LaFontaine to win his fourth season scoring title in his second Hart Trophy. Now, there are two ways and two perspectives to assess what happened with Mario Lemieux during that 1992-1993 season. The first would be to think about what might have been if he was able to play the entire season and keep his points per game pace. He clearly would have surpassed the 200-point milestone and likely, would have caught Wayne Gretzky with that record of 215. So there is certainly a what might have been aspect to Lemieux that year. But there's a second perspective, and that's the one that I choose to subscribe to, and that is combining what Lemieux achieved statistically on the ice that season during those 60 games, and then what he overcame in the middle of that season with his physical ailment. You rarely see anyone in any profession who's able to overcome the daunting on the physical side while at the same time performing at the highest level of greatness within their chosen profession. Lemieux did both, and thus that serves as not just our dedication for episode 93, but also as motivation for all of us as we continue to achieve in our endeavors and as we face life's unpredictable challenges. We are off and running. If Dr. James Burke is listening, I hope he appreciates our Far Middle ode to the science BBC television docuseries Connections. The first connection we'll make is going from discussing statistics with humans on the ice to discussing statistics with polar bears on the ice. I received quite a bit of feedback and questions from a couple of tweets that I posted on social media a few weeks back. And by the way, you can follow me on Twitter at Nick Deolius. I hope that you do so. But anyway, I came across a report from the International Union for Conservation of Nature. That organization has a polar bear specialist group. And that group recently estimated the global population today for polar bears to be somewhere between 22,000 to 31,000. Now, when I read that statistic, immediately I was interested in comparing it to what the global polar bear population may have been in prior periods in the past. And I certainly would have expected that the polar bear population would have been much larger in the past than the current estimates. Why? Because all the experts, all the environmentalists, they've been pounding a message that climate change and global warming and increased carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere, those things are pushing the polar bears to the brink of extinction. And a lot of us remember that heart-tugging video of a polar bear struggling in the water trying to stay afloat. But this is where things got interesting, and it's what led to the tweets on social media and why we're discussing it today on The Far Middle. Because scientists estimated in the 1960s that the polar bear population globally was between 5,000 and 19,000. Of course, that's substantially lower than today's estimated polar bear global population of 22,000 to 31,000, meaning that as carbon dioxide levels have risen, the polar bears, they found a way to thrive. Now, of course, that's heresy to even discuss, let alone to accept as fact, because those troubling statistics and those facts, they run completely counter to the ideological and religious tenets of the Church of Climate Change, which, of course, continues to be that as CO2 levels increase, everything from polar bears to human beings, we face a pending, immediate, and violent extinction. The fact that polar bear populations have substantially increased while carbon dioxide levels are growing, well, that's simply an inconvenient fact that must be suppressed or ignored or attacked so that the religion can remain unchallenged. The dynamic that we see where an ideology insists on ignoring or suppressing facts and certainties that inconveniently counter its core beliefs leads to quite damaging consequences, and they stretch beyond polar bears. That takes us to our next connection, which is what is going on across different school districts in America with regard to student achievement. Read recently that a mom was complaining about a school district administration in Virginia when they failed to inform her son that he had been recognized by the National Merit Scholarship Program. And as a little bit of background, if you're not familiar with the National Merit Scholarship Program, it's a competition that students across the country engage in, and it's based largely on scores on things like the PSAT exam. So students who earn commended status, they end up ranking in the top 3% of the test takers, while somebody with a semifinalist designation, that lands them in the top 1% of test scores. So the National Merit Scholarship Program, it's recognizing and identifying and providing positive reinforcement to our future innovators and scientists and doctors and disruptors and inventors, along with, I'm sure, a host of talented young adults in the arts and humanities as well. Now, why would a school district not want to inform one of their students that they earned the national distinction within something like this competition? Well, that brings us into the ideology that permeates school district leadership across a growing swath of America today. You see, it turns out that this school district in Virginia signed a $455,000 contract with a consultant to perform what they called strategic planning. And the consultant was keen to focus on student equity. Student equity was specifically defined in this instance as, quote, equal outcomes for every student without exception, end quote. Now, therein, constant listeners, lies a massive problem. As we've discussed in the past, there is a big difference between what appears to be nuanced terminology of equal opportunity versus equal outcomes. Equal opportunity, hey, that's necessary, noble, it's a prerequisite for any society that values individual rights. Equal outcomes, that's quite a dangerous concept in a Western Republican democracy and for individual rights. Because who determines equal? Who sets acceptable outcomes? And what happens when you destroy a meritocracy? And what message is sent and what outcomes do you motivate when you degrade individual achievement? And what price does a society or a nation pay when its best and brightest and most accomplished inevitably get demoted to keep everyone equivalent with equal outcomes? We could spend an entire episode on those questions. But that focus on equal outcomes for every student, it explains why the school district in Virginia failed to notify the student of his achievement when it came to the National Merit Scholarship Program. When the parent pressed one of the administrators on the matter, the administrator told the parent that the school wants to recognize students for who they are as individuals and not focus on their achievements, and that the school district delayed informing the winners and the National Merit Scholarship Program to spare the feelings of those who didn't qualify. Now, that's the way more and more administrators and leadership of our public education institutions view their strategic mission these days. Hold back the individual achievers and make sure everyone conforms to a lower standard or mean. That's not equal opportunity. That's equal outcomes in a substandard educational system. And is it any wonder that many of our school districts, particularly in the poorest of areas, are posting student proficiency levels for reading and math and science that are not just unacceptable, but that they're frankly just outright embarrassing? If at the same time public education leaders are intent on holding back the recognition and achievement of high-performing students, then not only is our public education system doomed, but the future economic competitiveness and the viability of the United States, both of those are in serious peril. Yes, ideology, and particularly rigid ideology, they can be a very damaging thing when brutally applied by governments or government institutions. And it's not just true for the ideology of equal outcomes in education, but it also holds true when it comes to the ideology of environmentalism. And we are seeing that with an exemplar of contradictory blunder by the federal government in the arena of environmentalism and climate change policy. It's sort of a Keystone Cops rendition, Washington, D.C. style. So let me give you the two contradictory ideologies that are coming to a clash with the environmentalism of the federal government bureaucratic state. On one side, there is the government obsession concerning electric vehicles. You've got mandates and subsidies and phase-outs and tax credits and trillions of taxpayer dollars that are thrown under the umbrella of the whole of government to do what? To force electric vehicles down the throats of consumers. We're told that this needs to happen, that it's an enlightened progression to help tackle climate change. And then on the other side, there is the government obsession, with the puppet master being the radical environmental movement, of keeping all resources in the ground. And those resources can range from the obvious of uranium and coal and natural gas and oil and timber and so on. But those resources also increasingly are including metals and materials needed to manufacture electric vehicles, specifically electric vehicle batteries. And therein lies the contradictory clash within radical ideologies embedded in government. Recently, the Department of the Interior decided to block off a large swath of Minnesota's Superior National Forest for mining. Now, what makes this especially interesting is that that area of Minnesota just so happens to hold one of the world's largest undeveloped mineral deposits of copper and nickel and cobalt. You need all three of those materials to make batteries for electric vehicles, which means you need to be able to mine all three of those materials to achieve the federal government's mandates and aspirations regarding electrification of the transportation sector. Now you see the conflicting and contradictory absurdity of state intervention in action. On Monday, and on one hand, the federal government throws bottomless subsidy and far-ranging mandates to force electric vehicles upon the driving population. The next day, on Tuesday, and on the other hand of the federal government, you see edicts that mining of any materials needed to manufacture batteries for electric vehicles is going to be prohibited in an area of a state that holds some of the richest deposits of those materials on Earth. But it gets more contradictory and more absurd, because while those two things are going on, the federal government, through the State Department, is hard at work making things even more convoluted. That's because in January, the State Department pledged to help build electric vehicle battery supply chains in the African nations of the Democratic Republic of Congo and Zambia. And it is not a secret that the environmental standards and the labor practices in the mining complex of the Democratic Republic of Congo and Zambia, they leave a lot to be desired relative to the standards applied in the United States. The substance of the State Department's efforts is to effectively offshore environmental destruction and human rights abuses so that the well-off suburbanite can purchase an overpriced electric vehicle as their second vehicle and receive a generous tax credit when doing so. A lot of those suburbanites driving those pricey electric vehicles maybe self-proclaim themselves to be environmentalists with the politically correct Climate Action Now sign in their front yard, and maybe the sign instead should say something like, "We support child labor and environmental destruction in faraway places." Probably too long of a slogan to fit on such a cute little yard sign. And there you have it, sort of a trifecta of government incompetence via state intervention under the cover of saving the planet. Use taxpayer dollars to stifle consumer choice and subsidize electric vehicles for corporations and for affluent buyers. Then you prohibit domestic mining of any of the materials that are required to manufacture batteries for electric vehicles, thus stifling regional economies and family-sustaining wages and jobs for those who would be employed in the mining sector. And then you use more taxpayer dollars to subsidize the development of the mining industry in faraway lands where environmental destruction and human rights abuses are nearly a certainty. None of it helps the planet, none of it helps the American taxpayer, and none of it will build a middle class in either underserved American communities or in the developing world. Now, why don't we hear more about this epic bungling by government? Where are all the government accountability institutions? Where are the alleged environmentalists calling out a net-net horrible decision for the planet? Where are all the nationalists on the right and the progressives on the left demanding that this incompetence comes to an end? And of course, you know, where in the world is the media and journalists who carry the duty to daylight facts and truths that impact society and economies and lives across the globe? Sadly, they're all AWOL because their fiduciary and moral compasses have been largely spinning off kilter for quite some time. But now you, constant listener, you are armed with the information and knowledge to help advocate for better outcomes and a more effective government. Now, as bad as it might be in the United States with our dysfunctional federal government, it could be much, much worse. And you don't need to look beyond the Americas to see situations today that are indeed much worse. That brings us to our next connection and dot to connect to, which is what is going on with the government and leadership of a key U.S. ally, Colombia. It's worrisome, and it should be cause for major concern, and much of it, once again, is rooted with an adherence to radical environmentalism. Now, Colombia has a new president, and his name is Gustavo Petro. Now, his last name is a bit ironic because although Petro is a shortened nickname for petroleum, the Colombian president is far from an advocate of the oil industry, which is odd because the oil industry in Colombia is a vital foundational piece of its economy. Oil makes up about a third of the nation's export earnings, and it also provides the energy that's needed for Colombia to grow. But you see, President Petro is a faithful worshiper in the Church of Radical Environmentalism. He says that oil is poisoning the earth, and he believes that climate change is going to lead to the extinction of the human race, unless, of course, drastic government action is taken. Boy, President Petro would make a great climate czar if he ever finds himself out of his current day job. But anyway, I did a little research on President Petro, and guess what? The president of Colombia is a former leftist guerrilla, and he turned in his gun and law-breaking ways, and now he's head of state who enjoys his travels and he enjoys speaking at places like Davos. And yes, he was an attendee at this year's Davos conference. Now, the president says that in 15 years, Colombia is going to transition from fossil fuels to renewable energy, and he has assigned the lead of this transition to be the Minister of Mines and Energy. Now, the Minister of Mines and Energy is another interesting personal study. Her background was as a university professor and an environmental activist. Strange that you would pick as the leader for mining and energy to be someone who is an ardent believer in the evils of both. The title, maybe it should be something more like the Minister of Anti-Mines and Anti-Energy. Now, the minister believes that climate change drives weather patterns like La Nina. So every time there are heavy rains and flooding in Colombia, she points to climate change and then traces the root causes of it to mining and energy. She then says that her policies and the government's policies are looking to protect human health and Mother Nature and that they are morally just. Does any of this sound familiar? Because it should. Now, I can predict with a confident level of certainty that if Colombia's president and Minister of Mines and Energy are able to follow through with their prescribed program, the Colombians are going to be facing unprecedented hardships in the coming years, and also that the Colombian economy is not going to be facing headwinds as much as it might be facing a mountain that it is about to fly into. The path that is prescribed here is not going to make Colombians better off, and it's not going to help the planet. Instead, it'll make Colombians poorer, and it will be doing great harm to the environmental health of both Colombia and the planet. Yes, if things are bad in Colombia now, they are about to get much worse once these policies are pursued. And we in America, the United States, we should observe the fate of Colombia and its economy over the coming years because it's going to serve as a potentially great barometer for what we will experience if we pursue similar paths. It's not another canary in a coal mine as much as it is another canary in the Church of Climate. Now that we're reaching the end of our episode 93 journey, how should we wrap it up in a nice final connection? Let's see. When we were discussing Mario Lemieux in his 1992 to 1993 season, I told you that perhaps the standout game in that campaign was his 5-goal performance against the Rangers in Madison Square Garden in New York City. And that gets me thinking about New York City back in history at a location on Manhattan Island, not far from where Madison Square Garden sits today. The neighborhood was known as Five Points, and it sat in Lower Manhattan. And back in the 1800s, it was largely controlled by rival gangs. That period of time in that Lower Manhattan neighborhood served as the inspiration for a great movie, Gangs in New York. Gangs of New York featured two actors who I think represent the finest actors of their generation, the two being Liam Neeson and Daniel Day-Lewis. I've been an ardent fan of both of these great actors since Schindler's List and The Last of the Mohicans. And to see them perform together in Gangs in New York, that was pretty special. But I have to share with you, constant listeners, something that's been troubling me about one of these two actors in the latter part of their career. Because the two actors have taken very different paths when it comes to career. Daniel Day-Lewis decided to retire from acting. And when Daniel Day-Lewis retires, he completely disappears. He would take breaks from acting in the past and would end up doing all kinds of interesting things. Once I read that he took a sabbatical to learn how to become a shoemaker in Italy. And apparently he ran a shop that had an entire customer base for all things related to shoes. So when he announced that he was hanging up the acting profession for good, he disappeared from the public eye completely, and no one has any idea where Daniel Day-Lewis is these days and what he's doing. Good for him. Liam Neeson, he took a different path. He started to do movies that were more action-based and that I'm sure paid quite well. And I've seen many of those movies because, again, if Liam Neeson is featured as a star in the movie, I'm not going to be able to avoid the temptation of watching it. A bad movie with Liam Neeson is still a movie worth watching in my book. And he has done some bad movies the past number of years. Those movies may have inflated his balance sheet, but I feel that they've diluted his brand. So when it comes to the two actors who I believe represent the generational best of their era, I have very similar and at the same time very different emotions. On one hand, up until a certain point in time, I love all of their work and consider both of those actors sort of different forms and different varieties of greatness. But on the other hand, when I think about both of those actors today, I carry two distinct emotions for each. I'll call them the M emotions, because I miss Daniel Day-Lewis with his absence from the movie industry, and I mourn for Liam Neeson with his more recent movies. That's how highly I think of both of those acting greats. I leave you with two quotes from the two greats, Liam Neeson and Schindler's List as, of course, Oscar Schindler. "I didn't do enough." That's words to live by if you want to live a well-lived life. And Daniel Day-Lewis from Gangs of New York is Bill the Butcher. "Civilization is crumbling." Hey, civilization will naturally crumble unless society feels a duty to uphold and reinforce it. So there you go, constant listeners. Do more and uphold civilized society. Let's check back in next week. Bye for now.